Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. How do the wise make decisions and lead businesses and organizations to great success? This is a question Bryn Zeckhauser and Aaron Sandosky posed to themselves after landing their first jobs as managers. Despite the best training the world could offer, Harvard MBAs and stints at McKinsey & Company, the elite powerhouse consulting firm, they felt unprepared when faced with the pressure to make critical decisions. So they set out on a 3-year quest to discover how people with remarkable success and experience in both corporate and public life, the whys, went about making crucial, often make-or-break decisions. They shared their discoveries in their new book, How the Whys Decide. We have one of the authors, Aaron Sandosky, here with us today. Welcome to the program, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
To begin with, why is How the Whys Decide so timely today?
When we set out on our research, we were looking for the universal principles that cut across great decision making. In a way, I think it's timely at any point when you have major decisions that have either gone extremely well or extremely poorly. Mm-hmm. If we look in the last few years, we have the decisions that led to the debt crisis, decisions that led to going into Iraq. So I think right now, folks feel like the leadership in this country, maybe they're not getting some of their important decisions right. So How the Whys Decide hopefully becomes a manual by which folks can understand what's at the core of true wise decision-making and wise leadership.
The subtitle of your book is The Lessons of 21 Extraordinary Leaders. How did you choose these extraordinary leaders?
It wasn't easy. There's a lot of extraordinary people out there.
Absolutely.
We wanted people that were wise. And to us, wise encompassed three things. The first is experience. We wanted people that had fairly long careers, minimum of 25 years, minimum of 5 years being in that CEO role or ultimate decision maker role.
Right.
The second component of wisdom we were looking for was folks that had proven themselves time and again. They had proven themselves in their careers or with their organizations and had a history of success.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third part is wisdom comes from doing things.
Of course.
So we wanted people that had been put in a lot of situations. And we specifically looked for leaders that had tough decisions throughout their careers. So we called it our ESP test, mm-hmm. experience, situations, and proven.
And how long did the research take?
From start to finish, it was close to 3 years, mm-hmm. very intensive in the early days. We spent considerable amounts of time with each of the folks. And the research really evolved around having them walk us through their toughest decisions, as much of the detail about it as possible, basically in their careers for the most part, although sometimes it went beyond just professional life. And then we would look for the common themes that cut across these individuals.
Right.
Half the time, these very wise leaders didn't even know what they were doing. They were doing it subconsciously.
Hmm.
Over 20, 30 years, they just figured out, well, I need to listen with purpose, or I need to be at the source. The onus was on us as researchers to try and find the common themes that cut across all these decisions.
You've identified 6 principles that the wisest executives use.
The 6 are go to the source, fill a room with barbarians, conquer the fear of risk, make vision your daily guide, listen with purpose, and be transparent.
Okay. Aaron, what rules should you follow in going to the source, and what is the source?
Going to the source is a short way of saying a relentless pursuit of primary information.
Yep.
What we found is across the leaders, they prioritize getting firsthand information directly from the field.
For instance?
Bill George, he ran one of the largest medical device companies. Medtronic would spend 2/3 of his time just with employees, with doctors, in the OR. It's amazing to think of 2/3 of his time being spent out there in the field. Mm-hmm. Likewise, Mike Rutgers, who ran EMC, one of the best performing tech companies of the 90s. Even after retiring as CEO, he would go on 400 customer visits when he still was around as executive chairman.
Right. Interesting.
Some of the techniques that these folks would develop for going to sources, one, you have to make it a routine part of your job. Bill George, who I mentioned, would set aside time to just be at different locations around the country or even around the world. At the beginning of the year, he didn't know what he would do at that time, but he knew he had to be out at the source, so he would just make it part of his daily routine.
Mm-hmm.
Another component is developing permanent sources. The reason for this is the value of source information lies in that 1% of time when things just aren't right.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a permanent source, you can go out to that source whatever it happens to be, and constantly monitor it to see when are things slightly off.
Right.
Good example is Bob Galvin, who ran Motorola from the 50s to the 80s. He would regularly walk the factory floors and talk with employees or visit with suppliers. He, you know, tells wonderful stories of always going to the same people in the company, frontline workers in the factories. And every now and then they would say, I'm just not so sure. And he knew that something was wrong. He didn't have to survey 200 of his employees. He just knew that when that one individual that was in one of his permanent sources was off, something major was off.
Right, right.
And there's a few more rules that we get into in the book about this. But the key takeaway with going to the source is that it's a relentless pursuit of primary information.
All right. Principle two has to do with barbarians. Who are the barbarians that you have to fill the room with?
The barbarians are all of us. Fill the room with barbarians is only about half the story. The chapter is about debate. And a lot of people have spoken about the importance of debate and fleshing out the pros and cons and maybe yielding new options.
Right.
And what was amazing to us is when we looked at where debate was being used to make tough decisions, the debate was the easy part. The hard part was how do you get everybody walking out of the room after having this very deep debate and discussion, almost like barbarians, wanting to execute together.
Yeah.
If someone has just advocated a completely different option than what was chosen, how do they go on the path chosen? So for us, the more important part of this ends up being after the room of barbarians, which is what we describe as a culture of candor. And a culture of candor is one where people are free to say whatever they want, as long as it's not a personal attack. They're allowed to disagree with the CEO. In fact, they're encouraged to disagree if they feel differently.
Right.
So this starts out about debate,
yeah.
But the trick to making debate work is the culture of candor. It's about how do you make the culture of candor part of your team, part of your group, part of your organization.
Now, one of the principles has to do with risk and fear. Could you expand on that, please?
Sure. So, Dave, let me give you a bet.
Okay.
We're going to flip a coin.
Sure.
And if it's heads, I'll give you $500. If it's tails, though, you have to give me $200.
Yep.
So my question is, do you take this bet?
Of course not.
Well, Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel Prize for work in behavioral economics, actually tested this bet. And he found out that most people would not take the bet.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is we all have this fear of loss aversion, the all-encompassing fear of risk. We just hate to lose.
Right.
So what does that mean in the business world? That means most people will look at a situation, look at a problem or a decision, and choose the path that is the least risky. The fear is if you go down a risky path, you could get fired if it doesn't work out. You could lose a promotion, or a whole host of other things could happen. What we found is the wise decision makers use loss aversion to their advantage.
Okay.
They focus on options that look risky, and they actively encourage their employees and themselves to bring forward risky options. But loss aversion tells us what people perceive as risky may not actually be risky. It just may be that they hate to lose. So anything that's moderately risky can get viewed as being extremely risky. The wise decision makers will get people to bring forward ideas, whatever the options are, and then they'll really zero in on the options that have high reward, high risk components to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll ask themselves a simple question. Is this high risk a perceived risk or an actual risk? And there's a few lessons in the book as to how to get at the difference. When it's a perceived risk, what you actually may have on your hand is a high reward, low risk option.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
I'm going to give you an example to bring it to light.
Sure.
Steve Schwartzman, who runs the Blackstone Group, was debating about an investment to make, acquiring a manufacturing company.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of other firms were competing for this, and it got revealed that the manufacturing company had asbestos. And suddenly, nobody wanted to buy the company anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Steve Schwartzman said, well, I don't really understand asbestos well enough. Just tell me about it. As he and his team dug into it, they realized that first, there was no asbestos at the plant. It was all in a part that they got from somewhere else. It was an entirely sealed part. They had insurance coverage going back for all of history that would cover any problem that ever did exist. And it's well vetted in the courts as to what is the liability of asbestos. So Steve Schwartzman said, yes, it has to be disclosed, but the risk of there being asbestos is practically zero.
Hmm.
So he went ahead, acquired the company. There was no one else bidding for it. So they got a very cheap price and made a wonderful return on that investment.
Very interesting.
That's the case of that immediate reaction to asbestos is this is a really risky situation. In reality, it wasn't.
Exactly. Also in the book, you talk about vision playing a role in decision making. What kind of role is that? And is it good or bad?
If you have the right vision, it's a good role. If you have the wrong vision, it may not be so good.
Okay.
The chapter is called Make Vision Your Daily Guide. The realization we had in looking at how people applied their vision is they applied it to every single decision. No matter how mundane a decision was, vision had to be applied.
Right.
The secret behind it is, A, you got to get vision right. And then you have to realize what role the vision plays in a decision.
Mm-hmm.
To get it right, there's three things that are important. Vision has to be a goal, something that people are going towards. It has to instill some sort of passion in your employees. And it has to differentiate you from your competition.
Right.
What's interesting about vision is, by its nature, it takes options off the table. Anything that's inconsistent with your vision should not be a decision you make.
Right.
So whereas most elements of decision making are about getting more options so that you can always choose the best option, vision is actually about eliminating options. The value of vision is when you use it for every decision, it actually makes an organization have this cohesive decision making body. Everybody is applying the same objectives, the same desires into their decisions. So you don't have to start canvassing a million different opinions all over an organization. You just inherently know what to do when you have the right vision and the vision is used on every single decision.
Absolutely.
But to be fair, this is extremely hard to do. There's a lot of examples of people succumbing to short-term gains and ignoring their vision, which is why I think a lot of employees and companies view vision as just a token expression. But when it's actually adhered to, it has extraordinary power for the long term of the company.
Aaron, Principle 5 talks about the ability to listen and really hear what is being said. To what extent does that influence a decision?
If you were to go ask anybody, is listening important to decision making? Everyone's going to say yes.
Of course.
If you then ask them and say, well, how do you listen? How are you a good listener? They'll say, I'll make eye contact, shut the door, block out external distractions, take notes.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that's the skill of listening. What we've found is the wise leaders really focused on the purpose of listening.
Right.
And what I mean by purpose of listening is before walking into a discussion to ask someone's opinion on whatever decision's at hand, they think through, what's the purpose of my entering this room? And there's really three purposes that matter. The first one is filling in gaps in information.
Yep.
Second one is learning people's hot points so you can figure out how to communicate the decision.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody has an opinion and they're very adamant about it, there may be a legitimate reason that needs to be addressed. The third purpose is generating ownership in the decision.
Oh, yes.
The power of our research, being able to look across 21 different people, what we found is these people really focus on asking the opinions of the employees working for them. You know, most of us think about, well, we have this tough decision. I better ask my boss, see what my boss thinks.
Right.
They did the exact opposite. They asked the folks working for them and asked them early in the process. And the reason is they recognize that a decision needs to be implemented.
Absolutely.
If you don't implement a decision, you might as well not have made it in the first place.
Right.
It's the employees working for you that are the ones who are ultimately going to have to implement your decision most of the time. So if you get their ownership of the decision because they've participated in it, it's a very, very powerful mechanism for having great implementation of your decision.
Exactly.
So what we found is listening is not what I thought it was. This is the one that probably surprised me the most. When I was at McKinsey, a number of different training sessions, a lot of which focused on listening and how to better serve clients, better work as a team member. And it was really missing the mark. It wasn't purposeful listening that people have been talking about.
Now, the sixth and final principle has to do with transparency in making decisions.
Transparency comes from walking people through how you made the decision.
Right.
It sounds trivial, but it ends up being one of the single greatest influences of good execution. And the reason is, oftentimes people will disagree with your decision. No one's going to agree 100% of the time. Tough decisions by their nature are going to have disagreement. Otherwise, they wouldn't be tough. So when a wise leader comes to a decision, the element of transparency is walking through, well, here's what was important to me. Here are my priorities in the situation. Here are my options. And here's why I chose this option over the other. Showing people what went into the decision. As a result, folks say, wow, I get it. I trust that person. I may not agree with it, but I at least trust them.
We've had Aaron Sandusky with us. He's one of the authors of the very informative new book called How the Wise Decide, The Lessons of 21 Extraordinary Leaders. Aaron, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Dave.
As always, we'd love to get your feedback. So please drop us an email at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.